6 months into his reign, Pius IX deigned to allow his Italian Catholic mother to come see him. She had to wear a veil. She had to wear long black gloves. When she came up the aisle to meet him, he stepped down a step and extended his hand so that she could kiss the papal ring. And as she did, he said, "Mama, with this ring, I rule the world in the name of Jesus Christ." It was more than the old doll could take. She threw back her veil, pulled off her long black glove, pointed to her wedding ring and said, "My son, without this ring, you wouldn't have been here in the first place." These basic things, these foundational things. And so tonight I want to tell a story. Indeed, I want to do four things tonight if you've got this kind of time, and I will do it even if I end up here talking to myself, which has happened on more than one occasion. Number one, I want to deal with a completely irrelevant fact, which is not at all unusual among lecturers, but I'd like to have you know I know it. If we get back to it, good. If not, please be gentle with me. I think we'll make it. Number two, I want to tell you the story. The story of Qumran, the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Because I think it reminds us that in other times when foundations were shaking, and when they had to get back to basics, there was a group of people in the Judaic tradition who belonged to the generation of Jesus and without whom I cannot understand Jesus. So number two, the story. Number three, I want to offer three reasons why I told you the story in the second place. I hope I get by with that. And number four, downstairs over coffee or tea, I hope some of you can come while we make corrections and comments about the story that I have tried to tell. Are you ready for that kind of a menu? If you please. The story of Qumran, the root and the flower. Number one, in Nebraska, where I grew up, we had a very definite theory of how we got the Bible. It ran something like this, that long ago and far away on a warm June afternoon in about 50 AD, just outside of Jerusalem, there was an ungodly clap of thunder, and all of a sudden the heavens opened up, and the original copy of the Bible in King James English came floating down out of the sky. It was only subsequently translated into Hebrew and Greek so that otherwise unemployables like me would have something to do. A little shepherd boy who was uncommonly well-trained in Elizabethan English ran and grabbed the scroll and realized what he had, rolled it up quickly, and ran and hid it in a desert cave, quite confident that if ever we needed it, we could have the original copy of what we unctuously called in my home province the Bible. Well, of course, we were taught that because nobody bothered to teach our families anything differently. I grew up in the country on a party line. I have an awful time with oral tradition. Yet deep in my heart, I know that the best of the Bible was there orally, told and sung around 1,000 campfires. Here's a bit of a genealogy. Here's the story of a battle. Here is a beautiful psalm. Here is a history. Here is an adage, here is a biography. And around 12 campfires in ancient Palestine, they began to tell stories, and they began to read passages, and they began to know them by heart because they didn't have books at hand. And as time went by, around certain great cities, Shechem, Bethel, Beersheba, Hebron, Jerusalem, people began to get lists of what were called canonical books, books worth reading, books that provide a rule for our daily life. And gradually Israel got together and said, this is the list of books which we call authoritative in our community. The Bible was never intended by the Jewish community to be a closed book. It was intended to be a foundational book. There are modern writings that have more meaning for many of you than the 13th chapter of Leviticus, huh? They better have, because most of you don't know what's in the 13th chapter of Leviticus. I'm not sure I do, but I could find out. So gradually time came, and they got a list of books which they called the Bible in ancient Judaism. And I remind you that that Bible of the Jews was the Bible of Jesus and the early church, and there wasn't a Bible in the Christian community until well into the second century. except the Old Testament, and Jesus of Nazareth never once called for any written material beyond the Old Testament. But because the holy name of God was written on these manuscripts, a name so holy that by the time of Jesus it had not been pronounced by any faithful Jew for more than 250 years, because that was the case, when one of these scrolls began to wear out, they didn't have a piano on which to store it, or an unused Sunday school room in which to hide it. They took the scroll on which the holy name was beginning to wear, wrapped it in clean linen, put it in a little box, and buried it in the cemetery next to Uncle Ezra, or in the loft of the synagogue. Let holy God destroy his holy name as he sees fit. We won't touch it. And that's my way of getting to the irrelevant fact, until the story I'm telling tonight began to happen. Until 1947, the oldest copy of any book of the Old Testament in Hebrew dated from 1008 A.D. Until the story I'm going to tell tonight happened, the oldest copy of any part of the Old Testament in Hebrew, the Bible of the Jew and the Bible of the early church, dated from 1008 A.D., closer to us than Jesus, much closer to us than to the authors of most of these documents. There were only two copies. One was and still is in the Leningrad Museum, the Hermitage in Russia. The other was in a synagogue in Aleppo. It disappeared in 1947 and turned up on the campus of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, where it still rests. I will repeat the irrelevant fact, and I believe every Jew and Christian ought to know it, that until the story I'm telling happened, our oldest manuscripts of any of the books of the Old Testament dated from 1000 A.D. Now, if all the story is as dry as that, you're going to be asleep in five more minutes. But hang in, I've got news for you. Comes point two, we're making progress, but watch it, this one hangs on quite a while. I want to tell the story of Qumran. Will you say the word with me? Qumran, please. Qumran. I can't tell a story unless I first have a locale and then unless I have characters for it. So if you will, please. Sometime before you have to do it in a wheelchair, I hope you go to the Middle East. And if you go to the Middle East, because I am a white-knuckle flyer who has helped pilots all across the world go up and down, it makes little difference, they don't know it. I hope you'll go in a civilized way, which is by ship. And after a little while, I hope you bump into the Palestinian coast and walk around Tel Aviv, Jaffa, and Haifa, and have a good time down on the coast. And then after a little while, I hope some ingenious member of your party says, there's a city up country, it's called Jerusalem, we really ought to go. If I sound a little sarcastic, I have watched across 10 years to see what Americans go half the way around the world to miss. Disgusting. But somebody says, let's go up to Jerusalem. And I say, great, I hope you have a good time. Somebody else says, watch the prepositions. Because while it's true it's only 40 miles from Tel Aviv up to Jerusalem, it's also true when you get to Jerusalem, you will be 2,400 feet above Mediterranean sea level. That's climbing rather quickly, isn't it? Not so spectacular for some of you out here, very spectacular for some of us back there. And after you've rattled around Jerusalem for a little while, I hope some of a member of your party says, how about going down to Jericho? Are you watching the preposition? And you will say, I've not had an all-consuming desire to go down to Jericho. And somebody else will say, it's only 13 miles down to Jericho. And somebody else will say, let's go by bicycle. And I will say, if you're going to Jericho by bicycle, check the brakes. Or you won't make it around one of those curves, and then you won't hear the rest of the lecture, which may indeed be a temptation. But whereas Jerusalem is 2,400 feet above Mediterranean sea level, 13 miles away in Jericho, you will be 1,300 feet below Mediterranean sea level. You will drop 4,000 feet in 13 miles. Why bother you with that? Because the setting of our story is located at the northwestern corner of the Dead Sea, down in this stinking trough where Jericho is. One present in this room and I were in Jericho one morning when it was 127 degrees in the shade. You will itch before this lecture is over. For Jericho lies, as does the Dead Sea, down in the bottom of a great trough with mountains on either side. Do you see them? I went to country school, isn't it obvious? With 8 classes in one room. Unless you were an idiot, you knew the whole syllabus by the end of the second year. We had our fair share. I remember in second grade spelling, we spent 2 weeks learning how to spell Cilician Gates. Except the teacher never got around to the one thing that even the country boy would like to know, and that is, what do the solution gates open onto? I'm not sure she knew. If she did, she would have said it was that break in the mountains between the Lebanon and the anti-Lebanon through which St. Paul went when he went over into Asia Minor. And she might have said, down in the middle of this great valley floor, like some God-appointed sentinel, stands Mount Hermon, snow-capped. And she might have said, the waters melting off of Mount Hermon flow into a lake which is called in Hebrew Kinnesaret, the Sea of Galilee, because the Sea of Galilee is shaped like a harp, and Kinnesaret is the Hebrew word for harp. And she might have said that the River Jordan winds like a serpent until it loses itself in the Dead Sea. And if my teacher in the second grade had been a scuba diver, which believe me, she was not, she might have known that that great rift continues under the Red Sea, where my scuba diver friends tell me there are forms of flora and fauna found in the hot water, not to be found anyplace else on the face of the earth. May I have another moment for geology, because this is all the geology I know. That great rift in the face of the earth continues until it forms the volcanoes of eastern Ethiopia. I was on a TWA plane one time and said to the pilot, do any of these volcanoes still smoke? He said, I've often wondered, let's go see. And for 20 minutes we went among the volcanoes. I don't know what the people in the back cabin thought. It forms the alluvial plain where the British farmers established their plantations when they went out to Kenya in the 1900s. Do you remember? In the middle of which stands Mount Kilimanjaro, saluting Mount Hermon. And rises and loses itself up in the tops of the mountains of Victoria and Albert and the great lakes of Uganda, which Herodotus called in 400 B.C. the mountains of the moon, and which he knew to be the source of the Nile. It is a phenomenal setting for a great drama. But the characters for our story come from a little town 6 miles south of Jerusalem called Bethlehem. They are members of the Arab tribe, the Beni Amran. They are nomads, which is to say they know how to keep ahead of the IRS. There are more nomads in America than there are in any other country in the world. The only difference is we have a different kind of caravan. For centuries, these Bedouin have been wandering around the desert across the Judean wilderness. And then when the wind and the rain comes across Palestine in December and January, the Bedouin, as with a lot of other Semites, make for the nearest Miami beach. And they hole up down along the north, down along the edge of the Dead Sea. And so it was in December of 1946. Let's get the scene clear. You people are out in the Dead Sea. Don't worry if you can't swim. Just keep your feet down and your head up. And this will be a little less dry than some lectures, I hope. You're facing northwest. The northwestern corner of the Dead Sea, the rock rises out and forms a little shelf about two acres in extent. And up behind it, like some God-appointed amphitheater, the great limestone hills of Judea rise to a height of 750 or 800 feet, forming a kind of an amphitheater here. They are sand, and that sand continues until you get to the Mediterranean Sea. December 1946, or was it January 47? Nobody knows, because the competent archaeologists were all busy doing second-rate things someplace else. If you look carefully, you see the Bedouin are here. The black goat's hair tents, right underneath this little shelf. This is a well-organized chauvinistic society. If there's any work to be done, guess who'll do it? The men spend their days resting. When evening comes, they roll over and continue the night doing the same thing. But they are a shepherding people, and this is a subtropical region, and there are predatory animals here, and so we can't quite rest unless we bring all the flocks together near the tents and set the dogs around them, and that's what happened. One of the elders of the tribe said to a couple of the young bucks, including one Muhammad al-Deeb, Muhammad the Wolf, who happens to be a friend of ours, now running an apartment house in Bethlehem, one of the elders of the tribe said to him and his friend, bring in the sheep and the kids. He said he got most of them, put the dogs around, realized that there were some of his flock that weren't there. Went up onto the little plateau, looked around, couldn't find them. Necessity is often the mother of observation. Looked up into the bluffs that formed the amphitheater, remember? And there in the pucked out caves, blown out by the wind, thought maybe he'd find one of the sheep or the kids. Shinnied up to one of the caves, threw a rock into the unexplored desert cave. That was a smart thing to do. Instead of hearing the bleating of the kid, he heard the resounding crash of pottery. Even the untutored in the Middle East seem to have an uncanny sense of the potential commercial value of archaeology. How long the Bedouins stayed in that cave, we do not know. When finally competent archaeologists came there, they found the floor of that cave littered with cigarette butts. We do not think these were left here either by the Romans or the early Christians. What did the Bedouin find here? We do not know. The outside world knows nothing of this. March 1948, early in the morning, across Bethlehem Square in front of the Church of the Nativity, two Bedouin boys, over the shoulder of one of them, a burlap bag. They were making for the shop of a shoe merchant who is called Can Do, which is not a very good Arabic name. Every village needs somebody who will answer Can Do no matter what you ask. The Bedouin boys carried the burlap bag into the merchant's shop. And I would like to tell you that I stand sometimes in front of that scarred shoe shop and on that desk, and I can hardly believe what I am telling you those Bedouin boys did. They knew the manuscript market was not very lively in Bethlehem. Can Do, will you take what we've got in the bag up to Jerusalem and see whether or not you can sell it? Well, what have you got, boys? Now, mind you, back in the Middle Ages when Leroy went to seminary, if anybody would ever say we'd find manuscripts from Palestine from the time of Jesus, they'd have been laughed out of the Pacific School of Religion. If one had said to Bruce Metzger in 1945, we shall someday find a manuscript from the time of Jesus, he would have haw-hawed you all out of Princeton. On that miserable shoe counter, are you going to believe me? Out of that burlap bag, those Bedouin boys pulled 11 scrolls, typically parchment, 11 and a half inches high. One of those scrolls is 125 feet long. Look at what we have. Two nearly complete copies of Isaiah, the long, long book with 66 chapters. Oye vey, look, a commentary on the book of Genesis, which we had never seen before. A commentary on Habakkuk chapters 1 and 2. The scholars had long said the third chapter of Habakkuk was a prayer stuck on late. A collection of psalms, none of them in our Psalter. Many of them quite as beautiful as anything we've got in the Psalter. Where are those people who said David wrote 150 and cracked his pen and threw it away? Some of them sung those beautiful psalms at Tanglewood by the Yale University Glee Club in English translation a few summers ago. A manual for military practice for those who would hate the enemies of the Lord with a perfect hatred and formed up in paramilitary organizations. A beautiful scroll of a book of rules for a community that was living in the desert. Professor Miller Brose of Yale said he had heard of a church in the United States that was ruled by a book called The Discipline. I happen to know about that rather painfully. So he called that scroll the Manual of Discipline. What have we here? 11 scrolls. Magnificent. Can Do went to Jerusalem, and I must tell the short of this story, even if it bores you a little bit. Do you mind if I put in a footnote? He went to an Assyrian archbishop in a monastery in Jerusalem and sold 5 manuscripts. The archbishop couldn't read Hebrew. He didn't know what he bought, but he thought it might be an interesting investment. Went next door to Professor Sukenik of Hebrew University, the father of Yigal Yadin, whom some of you know as the vice minister of the associate prime minister of modern Israel and a leading Israeli archaeologist. Sold the other 6. War broke out. Archbishop Samuel was an Arab. He had to get out of Palestine. Flew to the United States, where he was translated from being a bishop in Jerusalem to being a priest in Hackensack, New Jersey. You got to watch out for the appointive system. The 5 scrolls that he brought with him, he deposited in a bank vault in the Chase Manhattan Bank down at Wall Street. The line between the sacred and the secular is very wobbly. 4 years later, in 1952, there appeared in that great biblical publication, the Wall Street Journal, a little 4-line ad saying, "Biblical manuscripts of great antiquity for sale." Representatives of the state of Israel went incognito to Hackensack, and for a price that was only lately discovered in the federal district court case in Boston, they bought the 5 manuscripts that Archbishop Samuel had. And this is my long-winded way of saying that the 11 scrolls found in Qumran cave number 1 are all back in the museum called the House of the Book on the campus of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. For many people, this is the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I've got news for you. It's only the beginning, if you please. In 1949, as soon as the state of truce had been drawn up between the Arabs and the Israelis, the King of Jordan, governing from Amman, declared martial law around the north half of the Dead Sea. He went and got two competent archaeologists, an Englishman by the name of Lancaster Harding and a Roman Catholic priest by the name of Père Roland Devaux, who had been rattling around Jerusalem since shortly after creation, and asked them to carry out a series of systematic excavations. Will you itch a little more, please? You know, people are very romantic about archaeology. Archaeology is fun in an air-conditioned library. But archaeology in the Jordan Valley in the summertime is like digging post holes in Kansas in August. It's okay if you like that sort of thing, but nobody in his right mind would like it. So will you itch a little? Because between 1949 and 1955, Devaux and Harding carried on a series of campaigns. Oh, they found Qumran Cave number one. They identified the cigarette butts. But do you know what else they found? Hang in with me while I have my moment, would you please? They rediscovered Qumran Cave number one, number two up there in the bluffs, number three, number four, will you remember it? Up here on this little shelf just above the Dead Sea. Number five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11 caves with something like a library of manuscripts in every one of those caves. Now, dear colleagues, this is only 3 miles south of Jericho. We're embarrassed no end. We don't know who were here, when they were here, why they were here. Who was it had one of the best libraries the ancient East ever knew? Whatever happened that we lost them completely? And then Père Devaux, who was a marvelous old priestly scholar, remembered the archaeological evidence, the caves, in a semicircle, around this little shelf. Nothing on the shelf except that one little cave, Qumran 4. Did what you and I would have sense enough to do, begin to scratch in the sand on this little shelf just up above the Dead Sea. Found some extraordinary things. I don't know whether you're going to believe this or not, but if you don't, you can be there in 12 hours and check me out. The first morning, Devaux and Harding dug. Remember, you're still out in the water. Here's the beach, and here's this little shelf. The first morning they dug on this little two-acre shelf, they entered a pantry where they found in one morning more than 1,000 pots and plates and jars. I lived in the Middle East for 10 years. I can remember walking across the Sahara and hearing a hollow spot and tapping my foot. And oh, what joy when I reached over and found some little old piece of a handle off of a pot. 1,000 plates and jars in one place? Come next door with me, and I will show you right inside of that pantry a field stone corner, 8 feet thick and 15 feet deep. Now, I submit to you, nobody builds a wall like that on a motel when they're dragging a camel across the desert, unless the woman is a very, very demanding AAA traveler. This is a community life. Come next door with me, and I will show you in the middle of that shelf, that desert, a dining room 72 feet long. And down at the end, a little reading table where some ill-fated brother, in anticipation of a monastic discipline, had to stand and read the lesson while others had their locusts and honey in common and in silence. For those of you who have Baptist propensities, and I hope that includes most of us, carved out of the solid rock of this little shelf are 12 cisterns with staircases so you could go down to the edge of the water, circular or straight, and an ingenious Gibraltar-like system for draining the water off of the hills down through a channel which you can still walk and into these cisterns. Just outside and yet up on the edge of this little shelf, There is a row of rooms where an individual could read or study or pray or do whatever a monk does when he's monkeying around. I do not know. Just beyond that row of rooms and yet up on the shelf, DeVoe and Harding discovered a cemetery with more than 1,000 graves. Now, I submit to you, you have to stay in a place for a little while to get a cemetery with 1,000 graves. And what do you do with two facts? Number one, that everybody of the 80 bodies that have been uncovered, everybody is buried in a simple white shroud. That's either ultimate faith or ultimate cynicism. And what do you do with the fact that they are almost entirely the graves of men and little boys, possibly one or two women, out of 1,000? Down at the end of the shelf was a place where they wove flax into linen, and next to it a place where we find a whole pile of broken pieces of pottery, which means that this was the potter's shop. We stand puzzled because we have bumped into a civilization that we knew nothing about until this discovery. Who were here? What did they do? Why did they come? What happened to them? Where did they go? What was this good library doing out here? Then DeVoe remembered. Blessed be DeVoe. We have the manuscripts from up in the caves. We've got the archaeological evidence. Can we put two and two together? And DeVoe further remembered that amongst those 11 scrolls that we found in Qumran Cave number one, there was one that was very important. Do you remember it? A book of rules for a community living in the desert. Now, I'd like to foist off onto you some conclusions, if you can take them. And I'd like to say that the conclusions I want to foist off onto you are supported by more than 99% of scholars, Catholic, Jewish, Protestant, and secular, who were here. What did they do? Where did they go? Can you take a little more? Number one, who were here? The Manual of Discipline, that beautiful scroll from Qumran 1, makes it clear that who were here was a group of Jews who had turned their back on Jerusalem because it was impure. Now, to talk about a Jew who turns his back on Jerusalem is like talking about a Roman Catholic who won't receive the Blessed Sacrament under the Bernini's altar at St. Peter's. Where are they going? They're going to the desert. How do you get into the place? The Manual of Discipline says that there is a group who rules this community, a teacher of righteousness, and a council of 12. And if you want to get into the community, you present yourself at the gate. And they ask you, will you turn over your money on a non-refundable basis? And that separates the men from the boys. Then if they accept you, you become a novice for a year. And at the end of the year, you take an examination. And if you pass, you're a novice for a second year. And if you pass, you're a member of the community. But, says the Manual of Discipline, just because a person's a member of the community, don't forget that you have the obligation to speak correction to each other in love. Says the Manual of Discipline, and someone walks sideways, speak to him. He does not listen, two of you speak to him. He does not listen, bring him up in front of the community. He does not listen, cast him out and let him be as a tax collector and a publican from your presence. Sound familiar? It is repeated verbatim in the Manual of Discipline and in the 18th chapter of the Gospel according to St. Matthew. A group of Jews who have gone to live in the desert. What's their purpose? I'm going to sing the next paragraph, so get ready. If I had a voice like yours, brother, I'd sing the whole lecture. There is a motto at Qumran which makes it very clear what their purpose is. It's the third verse of the 40th chapter of Isaiah. If you listen clearly in the evening at Qumran, you can still hear that motto being sung. Prepare ye in the desert a highway for our God. Do you hear it? I'm sorry my voice is so bad, but I want you to remember it. Prepare ye in the desert a highway for our God. We are living in the latter days. Repent, the kingdom of God is at hand. If the third verse of the 40th chapter of Isaiah sounds familiar to some of you Christians, it is because it appears someplace in the first, second, or third chapters of every one of the four Gospels. Do you hear me? A very important text. Jews from Jerusalem, living in the latter days, prepare to undergo discipline. possibly celibate. Is that why there are so few out there of women? Bringing little boys into the community. Bearing a witness to God. What they do here? There's a beautiful statement in the manual of discipline that nobody is supposed to talk before the sun comes up. That wouldn't bother most of you. But at Qumran, you're supposed to be down here where the salt water will let anything grow, hoeing beans, doing menial labor. And when the sun comes up, you're supposed to get up, go back up into the community, do your ablutions, water from the cistern, put on a clean white garment, go into the dining room and take your meal in common and in silence. Go into the scriptorium or the little rooms. Spend your life studying, praying, meditating, thinking. Every so often you were supposed to go forth two by two without money and without weapon to man the soup kitchens which the Pharisees had established in the cities of Palestine for the poor. Every Friday afternoon you were supposed to train as the military arm of the holy community because you were to hate the enemies of the Lord with a perfect hatred. Life goes on at Qumran. There's a beautiful, beautiful suggestion in the manual of discipline that if ever you are charged because you keep your faith, and if you're ever asked to recant, you are supposed to die because you believe in resurrection, and it will be all right. And that's why everybody out there in a cemetery is wrapped in a simple white shroud, because like the Pharisees, they believe in the resurrection of the dead. Oh, I could go on and on, but you would be bored. And I've got to say one or two other things. Life at Qumran went on from 150 BC until 31 BC when there was an earthquake in the Middle East that shook down almost everything that wasn't on solid rock. And there are fissures in the walkways and in the cisterns at Qumran this wide. But we know that Qumran community was back here by the time of the death of Herod the Great and right across the historic life of Jesus. Until after 70 AD. I've got one more question to ask, and I want to answer it. And halfway through, I will run out of data and indulge in impure, adulterated Beck, and I will tell you exactly where that begins. The community is there from 150 BC, essentially until 70 AD. Those of you who know anything about Jewish history, and if you don't, shame on you, know that Rome had always been bothered with the Jewish province and with Jerusalem. You know that they had passed the Roman province around among the Roman Senate, the Roman Emperor. They didn't know what to do with what the Roman records called the damned Jew. In 66, the Roman Emperor decided they would be done with the Jews. And to this little dried up mountain town of Jerusalem, with fewer than 100,000 people, the Roman Emperor sent the head of the Imperial General Staff, Vespasian. That's like setting the whole United States Air Force against Lewiston, Idaho. 2 years later, with incredible casualties on either side, the Romans still hadn't taken Jerusalem. Vespasian was called home to be emperor of Rome, and so badly did he want to win against the Jew that he sent Titus, his firstborn son, to clean up Jerusalem. Some of you have been in Rome. In the Roman Forum, there is an arch to Titus, under which we're told no self-respecting Jew has ever allowed himself or herself to walk. It's a picture of Titus destroying the temple in Jerusalem. In 70 AD, are you still there? Titus finally destroyed Jerusalem. Some scholars say he ran a floor of concrete over the temple so it wouldn't fester out. Within a few years, Rome said, if you caught in Jerusalem circumcised or with a copy of Torah, it's a capital crime. But some Jews, refugees, escaped from Jerusalem and went down and holed up in a town that every Jew worth his salt knows by name, forwards and backwards. It is the town called Masada. Will you say it, please? Masada. Titus wasn't about to be laughed at. He sent the 10th Roman Legion up to the Sea of Galilee, with orders that they were to start south and clean out all vestiges of Jewish life. That means that our brothers at Qumran are sitting right in the path of the 10th Roman Legion. And that's the point at which the 10th Roman Legion's record stops. Can you take a little back? I think, I couldn't prove it if my jugular vein depended on it, but I think the brothers at the monastery heard that the 10th Roman Legion is coming down the valley. James Henry Breston used to say there's no point in putting telegraph in the Middle East. Word gets around faster by mouth anyway. It's almost like a Midwestern village, isn't it? I think they got word that the 10th Roman Legion was coming. I think that the head of the monastery called the members together. I think, he said, what happens to us, that is not important. But what happens to the holy books on which the holy name of God is written, a name so holy we have not pronounced it for 250 years, that is important. Did you ever notice when somebody attacks a synagogue, if they kill a Jew, the Jews are angry, but if they tear up the Torah, they are furious. I think the head of the monastery said to the brothers, send a message down to the linen weaving plant, clean linen, to the potter's shop, big jars with handles on, so we can tie the lids on. We have one at the school where I teach. Won't you come and see it? I think the abbot said to the brothers, and you can hear me wallowing in sentiment, can't you? Go into the library and take off the pegs, the scroll that you have been using lately, the one your father and mother sent when they were so proud that you became a member of the monastery, the one your mother-in-law sent as a thank offering when you left home. Wrap it in clean linen, put it in a jar, and take it up in the hill. The Romans will come, the Romans will go, but the holy books will not fall into the hands of the Romans. I think the brothers at Qumran were working away quietly. After all, one doesn't go to a monastery to hurry, does one? And one morning they got up to continue the job of hiding the library, and they looked out over the edge of the Dead Sea, and right there down on the beach, way ahead of schedule, was the 10th Roman Legion. What to do? I reckon the monks moved faster that morning than they had moved since the day they left home. I reckon some of them ran into the library where more than half of the manuscripts were still on the pegs and simply scooped them up in arms full and ran to the nearest hole in the floor. Remember I mentioned the only cave down on the little shelf, Qumran Cave number 4, and dumped them in the middle of the cave, which is open at both ends. Can you imagine what it was like for DeVoe and Harding to come into that cave in 1949 and there, like a pile of grain in the middle of an otherwise empty granary, to find more than half of all the manuscripts we found at Qumran, untouched for 2,000 years. What happened to the brothers at Qumran? Well, that's easy, says Professor R.B. Y. Scott of Princeton. Sorry about this. They became Christians. I can't quite agree with that, because I don't think the mere fact they became Christians rendered them such nincompoops that they forgot that the best library of the ancient Near East was up there in the hills. No. Neither do I think that the Romans were coming down the valley saying, if we could just persuade these Jews to become Baptists, everything will be all right. I think the 10th Roman Legion didn't have any tracts in their pocket at all. I think they were coming down the stinking valley of the Jordan in the middle of summer. I think they were saying, by Zeus, what are we doing here? I think they were dreaming of the bubbly girls and the bubbly wine under the Avenito. And I think when they hit Qumran, they went crazy. I think if you could have watched Qumran that afternoon when the 10th Roman Legion hit, just after they had dumped the last manuscript on the floor of Qumran Cave number 4, I think if you could have been there, you would have heard the whine of Damascene steel. You would have heard the death rattle in the throats of my brothers at Qumran. You would have seen them putting the torch to the sites at Qumran for anything that would burn. That's why there's a whole layer of ash. You would have seen the 10th Roman Legion kicking up their heels until they dropped 400 solid silver shekels on that little two-acre site, more than half of them from the town of Tiberias where they spent their last Saturday night. You say, man, you're really desperate for a tough end to your lecture, aren't you? And I will say, no.
I will remind you that when the same 10th Roman Legion 6 weeks later came to Masada, 15 miles south, where 1,000 refugees from Jerusalem had holed up, the 10th Roman Legion was known to be so fierce that 1,000 Jewish refugees took a pact among themselves. Every Jew knows this. That if the 10th Roman Legion began to win, they, the refugees, rather than be captured, would kill each other and commit suicide. And 6 weeks later, when the 10th Roman Legion finally took Masada, out of a company of 1,000 refugees from Jerusalem, there were, huddling against a wall when the Romans entered the fortress, 2 old hags and 5 little babies. All the rest had either been killed each other, or committed suicide. I don't think I'm exaggerating. I think the reason we didn't hear about Qumran was because the brothers of Qumran were done in. Damascene sword, death rattle, torch. If you had been sitting up on a Judean hill and had the stomach to watch this massacre, and watched that evening in 70, 71 AD, and heard the sun set quietly over Qumran, wouldn't it have hurt a little to know that a noble group of Jews had been done in, and that silence was to settle on Qumran, which would not be broken until in 1947, a Bedouin boy threw a rock into the entrance to a cave, and instead of hearing the bleating of a kid, heard the resounding crash of pottery. Why bother you with a story? I've got 3 reasons. Because I'm a trained clergyman, I will say the first one 4 different ways. You've been through that before. Incidentally, if I get excited about this subject, it is because deep in my heart I do believe, Gordon, I believe that when your grandchildren go to college and university, they will know you and me as having lived in, well, when they go to the physics laboratory, the age of the atom. And when they go to the history, church history class, the age of Vatican II. And when they go to the biblical studies class, the time when they discovered Qumran. I believe that. But now I said I have 3 reasons for having bothered you with the story. And I want to say the first one in 4 different ways. Here we go. The first reason for bothering you with this story is that from Qumran we have got more than 550 biblical manuscripts. I'll wait for that to soak in. Where are you, Bruce Metzger? Where are you who laughed that we should someday find anything from Palestine? I'm not putting Metzger down. That was the view of New Testament scholarship. And of old, 550 biblical manuscripts. Let me say it a second way. From Qumran, we've got 1 or more copies of every book of the Old Testament in Hebrew, except the book of Esther. I hope when we get downstairs, you'll ask me why I'm delighted that if there had to be one missing, it was Esther. But everybody's got an aunt named Esther, so I must be careful. 550. 1 or more copies of every book of the Old Testament in Hebrew except the book of Esther. Let me say it a third way. We've got a preponderance of copies of 3 books of the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and Psalms. If you know anything about the New Testament, you know it leans very hard on 3 books of the Old Testament. Chorus, Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and Psalms. And now let me say it a fourth way, and will you please get it? 550. Everything but Esther. Preponderance of 3. And according to the carbon 14 dating test, according to the way the letters are written, according to the ink with which the letters are written, according to the papyrus on which, the parchment on which they are written, the manuscripts from Qumran are dated at about 50 BC. Now come back to the irrelevant fact, will you? one place in Palestine, we have one or more copies of every book of the Old Testament, the Bible of Judaism and the Bible of the early church, that are 1,000 years older than our previously oldest copies. Sometimes when I hear a bishop pontificating about the Bible, I want to stick a pin in his pontifications. Do you realize at whose hand we have a literary tradition more than 2,300 years old? I don't know what your kids are going to do with the Bible, but I do know that I can stand in front of them and say, here is a tradition which has literary integrity for 2,300 years. And you know who gave it that integrity? I'll tell you. It wasn't the bishops. It wasn't Gutenberg. It was that half-blind scribe. I've been wearing these since I was 14 months old. As I go through the Middle East and see people writing without corrected vision, I have an awful time. It hurts me, but there they sit, lining the text with their nose, writing with anything but a Parker 51. Copy. 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 Well, you know, one of those scribes could have gotten a naughty look in his eye and with a flick of the pen made a fool out of all the bishops of Christendom. But they didn't. They didn't. Why bother you with the story of Qumran? Because we've got copies of every book of the Bible except Esther, 1,000 years older than our previously oldest copies, and they remind us of the everlasting integrity of the biblical record. But I've got a second reason for bothering you, and a third, and I'll quit. That's the first good news you've heard in the last 15 minutes. But reason number two, please. The fragment literature. Yes, you heard right, the fragment literature. Take all the jigsaw puzzles in Seattle, Spokane, and Lewiston. Put them in a cosmic barrel, throw in some water and sand and a little molasses, and come and get three handfuls and put them at the gates of Spokane. Where is that? With the weather like you've got around here, don't bother to come back in 2,000 years. You won't find anything anyway. Come back to Qumran, and you will understand why in the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem there are literally baskets full of fragments, broken pieces of text, like you were to take a dry old Bible and rub it like tobacco. What will you do with the fragments? Well, that depends on who you are. Lots of people started fires with them. But some people, tweezers under glass, put them together. Now, a nincompoop can't do this. Happily, almost never does a nincompoop apply. Tweezers under glass. Aramaic, Hebrew, Greek, tweezers under glass. I was a guest at the American ambassador's table in Cairo one time when on my right was Mrs. Carl Munt, whom some of you may know as the wife of the former senator from South Dakota, and on my left a well-corseted Englishman. Mrs. Munt leaned over her soup and several other things and said to the Englishman across my bow, "What in addition to a bulldozer and dynamite do you use in archaeology?" Some Americans are really ugly. After he got back up on his chair, the old Englishman looked at her and said ever so benignly, "In addition to a bulldozer and dynamite, we use a fingernail file and a toothbrush." She never knew what hit her. Tweezers under glass. A friend of mine is a Belgian priest. He's been doing it for 31 years, putting these fragments together. Last time I was in the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem, I looked through the doors and said, "How are you doing?" And he sneered lovingly, "Come back in 75 years and I'll tell you." Tweezers under glass. But do you know, one of these days he's going to put together another 23rd Psalm, a litany from a synagogue in Jerusalem in the first century, a psalm as lovely as that acme of Old Testament piety, the 51st Psalm. Tweezers under glass. And one of these days he's going to bless the human race in his quietness, as I do not bless it in much noise. Why bother you with the story of Qumran? The manuscripts. The fragments. Now hang on to the edge of the seat, because I got the third reason, and it's a big one. Where I went to Sunday school, one of the things we loved to say about Jesus was,
that he stood head and shoulders above a generation of dummies. Isn't that something else? You don't have to be very tall to stand high among pygmies, do you? And all the nasty things we could say about Judaism, we just laid them on. Anybody know what I mean? And most of us deep down wish God had used better sense than to have Jesus born a Jew. Couldn't he have been sweet? Or mirabile dictu, an Englishman. And many a time I have, as a little boy, heard a preacher who had been away fishing, hadn't done his homework, come home and kick the Pharisees around for a half an hour and call it a sermon. Do you hear the third reason coming? The first century of Judaism was a brilliant time. And with you, I adore Jesus of Nazareth, but he was not tall among a generation of dummies. He was tall among a generation of brilliant people. Hillel, Shimon, Gamaliel, Nathaniel, the Sanhedrin, the great teachers, and the brothers at Qumran who cared enough about the will of God to hit the desert and try to find new forms of piety, lest the heart of the faith should be lost. And at the center of Qumran, and at the center of the reform movement in Judaism, at the heart of it all, was the most beautiful word in Judaism in many ways, and that is the Pharisees. I want to say to you that I believe Jesus was a Pharisee. I want to say to you it was the Pharisees who let an unordained Nazareth boy come home and read the lesson in the synagogue. It was the Pharisees who said, we don't have to bother about sacrifice anymore. We will have a synagogue which will be a place of prayer and of meditation and study and social service. It was the Pharisees who were killed for talking about a doctrine of the resurrection of the dead. 20 years after the death of Jesus, Paul of Tarsus was saying, I am a Pharisee of the Pharisees and out of the tribe of Benjamin. Oh, how we love to celebrate the fact that when Paul was on his missionary journey, he would get kicked out of a synagogue by the Pharisees. But why weren't we fair enough to say that when he went to the next town, he made a beeline for the synagogue of the Pharisees? Oh, I know he was very sharp about the Pharisees. You whited sepulchres filled with dead men's bones. But I think that's exactly the same thing that we have in a church like this. When Mr. Calbon speaks more sharply about members of this congregation than he does anybody out in the street, why? Because he hates you? No. Because you always have to be sharp with the one you love, speaking the truth in love. That's, I think, why Jesus worked so hard on the Pharisees. I believe Jesus was a Pharisee. I happen to believe, though I can't prove it, that John the Baptist went to the desert from the time he was a little child to live in a community like this, preaching this message. Repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand. I would like to have you take a look at the Pharisees, for they are the mothering culture of the early Christian church. Oh yes, with you I adore Jesus of Nazareth. But I'd like to say one thing as I sit down. Don't show me the flower without showing me the roots.